This is the Brian Callen Show. All right, everybody. This is the Brian Callen Show. I almost said Brian Callen Podcast. That's the same thing. I'm hilarious. I'd say we were brought to you by, but I don't think I'm sponsored anymore by anything. That's all right, though. Don't touch my Zoom, Dove Davidoff. I'm here with the great.
It's really cool.
Dove Davidoff, probably my favorite stand-up comic in the country.
There you go.
And truly one of my closest and dearest friends. And so I wanted to get him on my podcast. I'm excited about this. Dove, what's going on?
What's going on? How are people supposed to answer that? I mean, there's the professional response, there's a career related response, there's emotional, psychological sort of. I'm not sure.
Well, you're a guy. I mean, I'm sorry, but you are as close to a true, authentic comic as I can think of. Dark. You get a case. You get a case of the black dog, as you call it, once in a while, where you can't get off the couch.
Yeah, I get a black dog.
You got a joke where you say, you ever feel like killing somebody, but you can't.
Yeah, have you ever been so depressed that. Or you ever been, how's it go?
You say you ever want to kill somebody, but you just can't get off the couch.
You can't muster
the strength to get off the couch because you're so depressed.
And enraged at the same time. You're thinking I could kill somebody if they were really close to the couch. Yeah.
Why do you feel that way, do you think?
I don't know. I think people are born with a sort of, an amount. You know how if you're born with some athletic ability, you can improve on that to a degree.
I know all You'll about never be... being born with athletic
Well, of course
ability.
You do. I mean, you...
Have you seen me run?
Nobody's more representative of
Have you
of
seen
a,
me run through a
man.
Field of tall grass?
Yeah, I have seen
Or on
that.
A track, for God's sake?
No, but like if you whatever speed you run at, you can improve by that. You can improve that by a matter of degrees through training, through the way you think, through whatever it is. You can work on an ability.
Right.
I think happiness is like that. I think you're born with X amount of it. And then, if there's something miserable taking place in your life, that's going to reduce it to the point where you have a problem. But I think, in general, there are people who are relatively happy. Every wealth study, the people that were happy before they made money are the same people that are happy after they have money.
But how do you think one – I know you've made a study.
And so I think I'm somewhere in the middle on the pendulum. It takes work for me to try and maintain a degree of levity.
Well, you said something the other night that I loved. You said, I can only really live on the edges.
I mean, the envelope is where I feel alive, and in between, you know, there's something about flat, safe places that make
like
me feel
locker.
Like I'm already dead. So I may as well continue to push, you know, the envelope.
Well, it's like
the, it
it's
is like the Hurt Locker.
Yeah,
it's like the end.
Yeah.
Whenever I'm like safe and I have a girl that loves me and you know,
nice
everything's
view.
Paid off and a nice view, I feel like that hum in the end of the Hurt Locker, and when he's walking through the shopping area and you just see all the colored cartoon cereal boxes in the
bright lights and the institutional hum
of safety, because it sucks. Because the only time I feel alive is in the middle of the night when I'm chasing down some tail that I'm not going to make eye contact with anyway, because I'm putting it in from behind and I don't know her name. It's the only time.
I do not know what you mean, sir. I do not understand that sensation one bit.
No, you know, I mean, in between sort of those extreme, and in between learning something and reading, I'm turned on by that which is intellectual, but also that which is often sort of instinctual and visceral and animalistic. And I don't know. I got a light feral quality. I'm like a razorback hog in the wild.
I would say for sure you are like a razorback hog, minus the tusks and the scent.
Minus the tusks.
But
and
you're
the
right.
Scent.
I mean, you are a feral guy, and I think you know, Sam Tripoli one time said, "Funny, and the normal ain't funny." I mean, you're far from normal. You grew up in weird circumstances, right?
Yeah, very
a junkyard.
Very odd.
Your mother moved you to India.
Yeah, my father's an uneducated Jewish business guy from the Bronx. My mother's a hippie intellectual wasp from California.
You got Jewish and wasp in you.
Wasp, yeah. Yeah, sure.
That's you where know. You get your barrel chest and your athleticism.
Yeah, is that where I get it?
It's where you get to, you can throw your hands.
Did some
boxing.
No, you try and figure out, everybody tries to reconcile their existence their own way, you know? It's like, for you, it was growing up in places that you weren't in for long periods of time. So it creates a kind of...
Look, the bottom line is
certain kinds of behavior, and that inclination combined with certain kinds of behaviors and abilities or inabilities manifests itself in who we are as people. And I don't like who I am.
But yeah, you, a lot of people would like to be you. I mean, you make lots of money. You're a very successful comedian.
Yeah. But the whole thing about the idea of what somebody else's life is like, no one knows. I mean, the one thing about reading biographies is like you read about people's lives who you think would be a real cherry place to be. And you realize that it's most of the time, it's just not that. You read
who are those people? Who are the people that you read about that most impressed you?
Oh, most impressed. Oh, well, you deal with the founding fathers. We could start there. I mean, the real giants among men. But beyond that, early American guys, all those philosophers, anybody who had the balls. Or then again, maybe it's not balls. It's like if you're Schopenhauer or Kierkegaard or Wittgenstein or somebody that hadn't been read almost until you die. It's like a Van Gogh scenario. Or I just read Modigliani's biography, which was...
He was a badass. My favorite painter.
Well, I think you're thinking of Caravaggio, who's one of my favorites,
I'm thinking about
too.
Modigliani. I know exactly his paintings. Those alien, those big, round faces.
Yes, round,
those almond-shaped
faces.
Eyes. Please don't.
No,
don't
you know
ever
your art.
Second
no,
guess
you,
my,
you know, you
my
know,
knowledge of art history.
You know your early 20th
Caravaggio
century
Caravaggio was a completely different thing. Caravaggio, they say, was an assassin as well as a beautiful painter. I don't know.
He killed somebody.
He
got into some trouble.
He could paint. Caravaggio, the only way to describe Caravaggio's paintings, you'd need Wagner in the background, just boom, 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 boom.
He was a bold painter. Yeah.
But Modigliani,
much more
to me is
subtle and
subtle.
Classic.
Oh, God.
But in his own style, it's very beautiful.
Those women that he paints,
he did a lot of bang.
He did, huh?
Modigliani. Oh, as a young man, are you kidding?
Of course,
he was half Jewish. He never really felt at home. Yeah, his mother, they were from somewhere in Spain. They were Jews, and his father was an Italian guy, and he grew up in Italy, but he grew up sort of with this. His father had lost money in business, but his mother was very cultured. So he grew up with a natural sort of
aristocracy.
So he had very cultured upbringing. And he could speak French with no accent. So it allowed him to sort of really, assimilate
into
French culture.
And I want to jump in because the for a long time, especially during his life and well after, the hotbed of culture was always actually France. I mean, Europe.
You moved to Paris.
Europe also was influenced by the French philosophers for the most part. Certainly French art, because French art was not just portraiture. French art was expressionist and everything else.
Yeah.
So the hotbed
of cultural and
artistic innovation was in France.
Huge. Yeah.
It really was.
Oh, yeah.
Including well after they became militarily weak, etc. So it was not England. England was great at commerce and institution.
Yes.
But
in terms of culture and art, I mean, French was sort of the apex of what Europe had to offer around that time, I think. And which is, I guess, is the Montmartre area.
But most of the aristocracy in Europe, I'm talking about from Russia to Poland, to when you were an aristocrat, you spoke French.
Oh, that's interesting.
Very important to speak French. And very important that your house was decorated with French furniture.
Oh, that was an indication of taste.
Absolutely.
And culture. Yeah.
So it's not surprising that Modigliani spoke
French. Very fluent French.
Any more questions about Modigliani? Or did you
no,
want to correct me?
Anymore.
Did you want to correct me on the fact that I was talking
absolutely
about Caravaggio?
Not. I thought you were going to go with Caravaggio, but yeah.
No. Thank you.
Well, I had them confused, which is how I started reading Modigliani's biography.
Okay.
And then I realized halfway
don't
into
project,
it that I wasn't
don't
reading
project on my podcast.
No. No, I would never paint you with the brush of ignorance that I should be painting myself.
No,
with.
You're
but
not
the,
ignorant. Yeah.
No, but it's it was just interesting.
But now, hold on. If you told me I was going to be reborn an Italian painter and a genius.
I think if he was all those things.
I would say sign me up because it sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
Was he not happy?
Well, in early 19th century, what happened was he was very great. Like, you ever hear those stories about Robert De Niro's father was that painter who he could have sold the painting but chose not to?
Yeah, well,
like
De Niro's father's featured, I think, in the Met.
Right. But the point was with him, it's like unless he felt you really deeply appreciated what he had done, he thought that Cubism was a trick. He thought that the direction that art was moving in was sort of... That he respected Picasso and those guys, but he believed it was sort of
pop culture
or a ruse or something to go, hey, I can get people to buy this because they don't know what it is, but we'll tell them it's cool. It's just that sort of Yeah. Overly intellectualized kind of art.
There was a lot of critique of that, but the idea that people with money will buy because they want to belong to an exclusive club.
Yes.
So that's where Rauschenberg and Kenny Scharf and all those sort of pop artists, but, you know,
came along. It's ironically, I mean, you think of, I guess, the early 1900s as at least in America, was put of kind of a religious, in a kind of conservative time, mm-hmm. whereas mm-hmm. Paris was a very wild operation they were running. I mean, he ran around. I mean, they talked about how promiscuous, and he used to fuck all his models, the women that would sit for the painting.
Which is really interesting to me because it was right on the heels of World War I, which at the time was by far the worst war anybody had ever experienced. The trench warfare, it went on way longer than anybody thought.
That's when a lot of the problems started. When war started, everybody got very poor, and there were no resources, and he didn't have any resources to begin with. His family would send them like a stipend or whatever you call it. They'd send him money every month.
But that's so interesting to me that after World War I, it's almost like people said, well, there's no point in, you only live once.
Yeah.
And when a lot of people we know have died already.
Well, that's interesting. You know,
I wonder.
The idea of loosening up as a reaction to the times.
It feels that way. Yeah, I would imagine that psychologically, you know, you've got an...
It didn't happen after World War II. It didn't happen that way after World War II. But that very well could have been.
It probably didn't happen after World War II as much, I would imagine, because the world was broken up into very, you know, think about the world was divided between a democratic and very repressive communist regime. I mean, there was no art to speak of.
Yeah.
You know, remember, the Soviet Union was ruled by Stalin, and I don't have to tell you what he did to his own people, Khrushchev, who was no nice guy himself, and this notion of communism, this movement, was not something that, from what I understand or what I saw, nurtured the arts at all. It stifled innovation. It did not reward the original. There was no room for the original.
No.
There was no room for the original because
which is
the
another
original,
form of religion, right?
Well,
that's Stalinism. It's like a real kind of
the
state became the god.
That's exactly right.
And you would forego your individual kind of ness, or that which you wanted for yourself,
because an individual was not
for
part
the greater communal effort.
And to me, it's the great evil because there was no room for the original. And if you were an expressive person.
Yeah.
Generally, and by the way, see Mao's China. If you wore glasses and you read and you were a writer, God's sake, if you owned property, you were killed.
It was very anti-intellectual kind of regimes because you don't want the people questioning. I mean, it's also why, you know, they send young people to war. I mean,
because the idea was you could create the perfect society and the perfect man, the utopian society. It's where totalitarian regimes come from.
Yeah,
that's the notion. Totalitarianism meaning control over the total person, their thoughts and their body.
And that
to me was one of the great things about
it's very anti-human spirit, you know.
Well, and you know, people always talk about, well, we have a lot of problems in today's world and stuff.
Although,
like that.
You know, I was talking to Wayne about this, and the about how I felt like you think about America. I was reading this Ben Franklin biography. So reading about, you know, I mean, the founding father were tremendous and sort of the Thomas Jefferson ideals and ethics and what they wanted to create and the reactionary response to aristocratic Europe and all that bullshit over there is that it seemed much more pure, I guess, maybe a hindsight. But now every time I hear about sort of principles of freedom or principles, that all makes sense to me if it's practiced. And then I was listening to some lecture about the support of, we were supporting, weren't we giving like $200 million or $1 billion a year to Egypt's, the guy they just overthrew in Egypt? I forget his name.
Mubarak?
Mubarak.
We gave money.
Saudi Arabia is the most backward culture.
That's right.
I mean.
But you have to put that into context. You have to put Egypt into context. You have to put, because remember, Egypt had been at war with Israel. They signed the Sinai Treaty.
All that's fair. And I understand why you're paying off the strong man. Just don't tell me that your principles for doing it are democratic.
No, it's geopolitics, man. It's geopolitics.
Right. So then don't tell me your principles are it's all about freedom. The reason you do things is for freedom. Clearly, there is data and evidence that that's not
the case.
Of course.
We support Saudi Arabia. Remember, Saudi Arabia supported
a
great deal.
I don't like being told that. I don't like the government going, hey, we're all about democracy.
Well,
are you?
No. But hold on. You're right. You're right. The biggest problem with being a politician and being a country, especially a country of power.
Just don't lie to me about it.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah. Just say, hey, listen, man, if you run a business, you say, hey, we have to make a profit, so I have to buy it for less than you do. Tell me that you bought this for $20 and you're selling to me for $20. Yeah. I know you're lying.
That's right.
You know, and I don't being lied to.
And the duplicity in our foreign policy, which is, I don't know how you would avoid it, is one of the problems that we had with our standing in the Middle East. It was always the knock on the United States.
If a politician,
you know,
said to me, if they were like, hey, man, we're doing the best we can, the reason we have to support this regime is because if we don't, it's going to get even worse and more messy.
Listen, the country that supported these madrasas, these religious schools in Peshawar and Pakistan and in Saudi Arabia, that it was all Saudi money. It was all our biggest
ally.
It was the biggest ally.
Yeah.
So yes, there's no question. But look, listen.
It's part of real life. It's lesser of a number of evils, and we do that every day.
Let me give you a great example of what we're dealing with now. Syria. The Assad regime in Syria is killing its own people. And very brutally, this just massacre 4 days ago or whatever, they killed 50 children. The forces came in and killed families. Yeah. They shot children at point blank range. Now, there's an outrage everywhere, including in Syria. And there's a great deal of pressure on from various parts of the world, including our own government, on the Obama administration to do something about this. Yeah. Mitt Romney's calling for it. McCain's calling for it, etc. Here's the problem. And
absolutely.
Who do you arm? Who are you going to go punch in the face?
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you know who these freedom fighters are?
Yeah, you arm them. Maybe they put. I mean, well,
we did the same thing with the Mujahideen. Exactly.
Precisely. And that's who the Taliban. That's where they peopled the Taliban.
That's right. So when you're in a position of power, it's very difficult to make these decisions because then you get people who say rightfully so. They had a guy.
I don't argue.
He said there's a moral component. The world has a moral obligation to bail the people of Syria out. Well, okay, you're right.
But how do you do that? Absolutely.
How do you do it?
Listen, I mean, I was reading some statistic about Africa. It's like all of the aid money, if just getting the aid, let's say you got boxes of money and you just want to get it to the people. You can't get it to
that's
the people.
Right. That's right.
They have one of those dictators storing food to bolster his side and whatever the conflict was.
Right.
Like, try getting it to the people. You can't just go in and solve it.
What happened
in
Somalia? And what happened in Ethiopia?
Right. My beef is just be honest with me. I realize every now and then there's some underhanded deal taking place.
Well, that's what geopolitics is. You know,
You choose your side. That's true. Here's what's not true. When a politician looks in the TV camera and goes, well, we're doing this for our democratic ideals. You're not. You support regimes that are anti-democratic.
Well, however, I do believe that the United States and a lot of people
in
our government...
If all of these are equal, they would prefer democracy.
A lot of people in our government and the United States in general has a lot of very good and idealistic people in power who try to do the right thing. I do think we, are, as a democracy, ultimately politicians are responsible to a populace, and that is that it's not perfect, but that is this country represents as close to that ideal as you can.
Better of the, you know.
But what I'm saying is that a lot of people, for example, in the CIA, I believe in our military, the CIA, in our State Department,
I believe they care.
I believe that they do care, and I believe that they're actually
trying to do the right thing. My beef is with someone who tells me we're only doing this for democratic ideals. You're a liar.
No, you're right.
And there are millions of people.
It's a messy game. There's an article in the New York Times.
So tell me we're doing the best we can. Don't tell me we went in there for our democratic principles because we care about their freedom.
But that's what a responsible press is. The New York Times had an article recently about Obama has a kill list. They give him a kill list.
Yeah.
They say capture or kill. The problem was two of the people, one girl was 17 and another boy was 17. Yeah. And so if he gives an order to capture or kill, typically they're going to kill him.
So, man, you can't have sex with a 17-year-old girl, but you can kill her.
This is the murky. You can't have sex with a 17-year-old girl in Vegas.
Is that true?
Not that I've done it, but I'm just saying that is a fact. Now
that's interesting.
What am I doing in California?
Yeah, that is interesting.
But the bottom line is I would not want to be somebody in power. I wouldn't. It's a very difficult fucking job, man. It's big responsibility.
Absolutely, it is. No doubt about it.
We have American citizens on that list, and we killed an American citizen in Yemen.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that, right? I mean,
the question is who's
they represent some sort of major.
But
a
the,
clear and
the
present
question
danger.
Is the question is a lot of the evidence that they use to kill the American citizen is top secret. So
right, so we don't really.
It does raise questions. Yeah. I don't know, man. This is what they call the fog of war.
Yeah, the fog of war. Sure.
You know.
Absolutely.
It's a mess.
You know. I mean, even when you're fighting the good fight, you know, like, you know, in World War II, when you didn't have a choice, when you're really doing the right thing by the world, it's still a messy game.
Guys who are listening, I have a podcast called Mr. Pink, and I think it's on, I think it's on Red Band's, when I was with Red Band and Death Squad, and I'll get it for myself. I'll put it on my website. But don't say the name, because I think you know the guy's name, but he's a real CIA paramilitary guy. And you should listen to how he talks about Joe
I'd love
Baldwin's.
To hear it, man.
I learn something every time I talk
yeah,
to him.
Yeah, I'd love
guy,
to
man.
Hear
it's
something like that. I mean, it's also a unique
Let's get to American culture. What bothers you about our culture? Because I know a lot does.
Well, I mean, the list would be much shorter if it was what doesn't.
Let me put some words in your mouth. Yeah. I know you love the fight game.
I love the fight.
I know when you feel the most alive, you're either on stage with a broad or in a ring.
Sure. Yeah, or watching fighting or reading. Yeah.
What is it about fighting? Do you think that
it's a meritocracy in a world without them? It's a truly beautiful sort of I art form. I don't want to get into semantics. I'm not sure what, you know, we'd have to define art and all that, but it's one of the few honest things that you can experience in a world without that. It's like most of pop culture is, you know, sort of, there are very few films that come out that are made about stories that I want to see or experience.
Do you have some favorite
most
films?
Comics I think are horrendous. I think they're dopes. You know, and so when something happens, that's what it is. It is what it says it is. You know, it's like I'm obsessed with sort of a sense of justice or a sense of like, you know, I just want a meritocracy. I want somebody to go, oh. And that's what I loved about the in this country when it was first beginning. That's what everybody was talking about. They were like, we want to create. It's impossible to create a meritocracy.
Well, it was that way unless you were black or Chinese.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was an enormous hypocrisy. But that it was a reaction to that aristocratic sort of titling.
That's what Thomas Paine wrote in Common Sense. Common Sense was all about that.
And so in the essence of that kind of ideal, the ideal as well, you know, it's an effort.
It's raw competition without any, like, nothing's going to help you unless you have the skill and the courage and the intelligence.
All those things maybe are true of a basketball game too, but I don't feel the same way about it.
Well, but isn't basketball
the fighting game
isn't basketball and boxing? I mean, isn't basketball? Isn't
anything
every
with
sport
the ball,
a watered down version
a fight,
of fighting?
Yeah, sure it is.
I mean, it is, right?
Absolutely.
What I love about the UFC is it's two men who get in there and they're basically coming as close as it is possible to kill each other with their bare hands. And for me, that's what's so amazing about it, the amount of skill it takes. And from I love all sports. I love football. I love watching baseball, basketball, and they're beautiful games, but they're complex games,
but they
have their own skill.
But they're games. They're not
fights. Yeah, there is something about watching two men really bang it out that taps into the caveman in my genes. I just admire it so much.
Yeah, and I think that's even...
You know, we were hanging out with Mayhem Miller last night.
Yeah, last night, yeah.
And you and I, and I was looking at that guy, and, you know, he's lost. He's had some tough losses, but, you know, you look at that guy. He walks around at 210 pounds, and
he's got huge hands.
He
just rehydrated that. He may walk around heavier than that. I mean, he fought at 85 4 days ago.
Yeah, he's just a giant with those hands, that big jaw. I mean, I just feel like a girl around him.
That's exactly what you are relative to what you're talking about. I mean, relative to that part of him, you know? Uh-huh. It's like... Yeah, it's.
I remember you looked at his hands and you looked at yours and you went, "Look at his hands."
Yeah, I know.
Me too. I got these little fucking hands.
Yeah,
that guy's got.
I'm thinking to myself, "Hey, yeah." I mean, like, a dress should have come with these hands.
I know he's got a set of mitts.
Yeah, it's a real hooks.
But you know what's funny is that we're all vulnerable. What's funny is that we're all ultimately made of flesh and bone.
Yeah, but we also, I think there's a natural inclination to admire that which you don't possess.
Yeah, well, that's for damn sure.
You know, it's like Mark Twain said something about that, but it was, you know, like even Fidel Castro said something about that. He was like these politicians that could read and write, these really crooked guys that he wanted to murder, you know, would come to the countryside, and all of these sort of hill folk that couldn't read or write would look up to these guys, and he knew they were scumbags. Jeez, you know, that's what I hate most, I think, is that element where you're being lied to. And I guess I feel like in pop culture in this country, I think much of it is kind of a lie. I mean, much of it is not really taking place. It's like you see an actor on the cover of a magazine. I'm not saying you can't appreciate the actor's work and they're emotionally facile and they got a beautiful smile. Shut the fuck up with your opinions. Unless you've written something, read a lot, which you probably haven't, because you, with the exception of a script that you memorize pieces of, just, it's fraudulent.
Yeah,
I don't like frauds.
Right.
I just like people who just say, this is what's going on.
It is fraudulent. That's why I it's amazing to me that we live in a culture that admires actors and not writers. I mean,
that's a huge issue, I think.
Well, it's
clearly symptomatic of something that's gone astray, you know.
But great innovators, writers, those are the people who should be on the cover of our magazines.
There's nothing about it.
Instead, we're watching
bits about it. Rogan's done bits about it. All these people have done bits about, you know. I was writing a bit about Fuck a Scientist instead. You know, the people that the average, you know, woman or man for that matter is attracted to are not representative of the best of what we have to offer.
No, we like symmetry and we like smooth skin, and I, for one, am one of those people.
Well, you don't mistake it for something else.
No.
You're not going, I want to hear this person's political opinions because of that.
Right.
And that's what the problem I have. I don't have a problem with going, if you like something for what it is.
Sure.
Just be honest about what it is.
Like Kate Upton doing the ducky.
Or
the Dutchie, whatever it's called.
Yeah, whatever
that girl
it is.
I watched that and I was like, that's probably the hottest thing I've ever fucking seen in my life. And I could be her dad, which I would make her call me daddy. Please understand that.
That's right.
And I have a right to. And I'm sure if she saw me, I would charm her pants
off. There's something about even like when people talk about culture in France, you know, on the street in Paris, people's like, these people are rude. It's like, no, they just don't smile for no reason at everybody. It's
like when I go to a gig,
you know, somewhere, and you go and do local news in the morning, and you got these people that are smiling, and it's like they're on a laugh
it's
track
amazing.
Or something.
It's amazing.
It's almost like it's just
when
just
you see
this makeup,
that's
and a
right.
smile,
oh.
and it's this.
What a terrible job!
Wrote about it. Yeah.
When you do those, I do those shows. You know, we both have done a lot of those morning shows, local morning shows.
Hey,
this is Tom from Fox News. Whatever. And you're like, man, dude, you read off a teleprompter and you smile with all that makeup. That's got to be a terrible fucking job. And for some people, that's the pinnacle. I'd rather die.
Well, that's the thing.
You got a big square head with a great haircut
and a great suit and a lot of orange makeup. Yes,
and
nice
you're just
makeup.
Reading from a teleprompter and you're just a great guy with a great voice.
Yeah.
Kill me. Kill me right now.
Yeah,
I always feel like doing something really inappropriate.
That's how you ended up doing what you do. You know, that's the inclination is to not listen to the rules because I don't believe in the rules.
Well, yeah, obviously, you know? I'm looking at all your tattoos.
I don't know about that, but
you got a lot of tats. You got a lot of writing on your. Where is that from? Victor Frankl's book. You got a paragraph from his book.
Ernst Becker. Yeah, it's about.
Oh, it's from
creating
Ernst,
meaning.
It's Ernst,
you know.
Ernst
yeah,
Becker.
Yeah, sure. We're the only animal that knows it's going to cease to exist, so we got to create our own meaning. We got to figure out like. You know, I mean, unless you're faith-based sort of reasoning or religion, it's like you have to create your own meaning because there is no inherent meaning in existence.
I've always been a little jealous of religious people.
Me too.
That sense of faith.
Oh, God, are you kidding? If I could just go, hey, man, that like the meek shall inherit the earth, that kind of thing. It's like, hey, fucking, no matter what's going on, I show up in church on Sunday and I do the right thing and I behave and then I go to a really good place forever. It's like... clearly that shit was made up by somebody trying to
a lot of the founding fathers
were not literally religious.
There was an idea of providence. It was a strong idea, the notion that there was God out there. And
No, but ideas of God. I don't disagree with that. If you tell me you have a figurative idea of God, that's great, man.
Me too, yeah.
I hope, you know,
on
some string theory, you know, physics level, I hope we can, you know, figure something out that says, oh, there is some form of order in the universe. Or just believe in a general sort of, we're all stardust. We don't know what's out there, but I believe there is a human spirit, you know. It's a form of a God. It's a form of sort of an ethereal thing to look up to, that there is a greater sense of something than ourselves. But when you tell me it's a guy who cares about whether or not I jerk off, then you're an absolute psychopath.
Yeah.
You're a psychopath.
Well, that's where religion, I think we're, when
like
religion
abortions, I think
into...
everybody that's thinking about an abortion should get one. Everybody. I mean, these abortions, they should hand them out. We should encourage everyone.
But what if I told you, that
that's an exception that, to the rule.
But no. But scientifically, there is a way to make an argument to suggest that a fetus of 2 months old is just like you, except for just not as developed. So just like an infant isn't as developed as
I'm
you
fine.
Are.
I'm fine with doing away with it.
You are. Okay. So you put a price. You put a price on human life the way most people do.
I don't even think they're people until they're like 3 or 4. Absolutely.
Well, the way I look at it is
2 months?
Is
2 months?
We put price on human life every day. I mean, if you really want to save lives, bring the speed limit down to 30 miles an hour on the highway. It'll save a lot of lives. Nobody wants to live that way.
Price, are you kidding? There's mass. What's it? Ethnic cleansing still going on in certain parts of the Sudan, in certain parts of Africa.
No, I'm just talking about polite society, moral society still puts a price on human life.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because you do.
Peter Singer stuff. He was talking about sort of morality involved in eating meat. And he's like, it's a sentient being. Now, you can argue, you can rationalize it. And I eat it, so I'm a hypocrite, but... At least I know I'm a hypocrite. I don't mind if somebody's a little hypocritical if they admit it. It's like...
It's funny you're saying this because I've been thinking a lot about eating meat lately.
Well, it's wrong.
Yeah.
And it's wrong on the following basis. Peter Singer is this philosopher out of Princeton, a brilliant guy. And he writes all about ethics, right?
I know who Peter Singer is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a lot of people don't. But ethics... And so it's
I'm
good.
Sorry, you're right. We're doing a podcast.
Yeah, we're doing a podcast.
I keep forgetting. I forget literally that we have a mic in our hands.
Yeah.
I literally forgot I'm doing a fucking
podcast.
That's funny. What is the book he wrote?
It was on ethics or something. Yeah. Or something. But he made an interesting point, which was he was like, well, okay, so you can eat animals because there's a differential in intelligence? That's really the argument, right? Yeah. Is that you're superior intellectually. Okay, well, then compare a severely retarded child with an ape, and you will find the ape, in many cases, more intelligent. You can prove that. Mm. You know, you prove it through Occam's cognition test. You can prove it. It's like, is it then okay to eat the baby? It's like, his point is, it's a sentient being. It's a being that moves towards pleasure and away from pain, just like we do. Mm-hmm. You have no right, and... If you extrapolate the idea out further, if the aliens were to come here, and anybody who can reach here from a star, which the closest one's 8 light years away, is clearly technologically far more advanced than we are and probably far more intelligent.
Yeah.
Maybe the differential exists between an alien and us. It's the same difference between us and an ant or whatever.
In India,
can make an excuse based on our philosophy to keep us in cages and eat us.
Well, you know, in India...
And I don't want to be eaten.
In India, the Jains, which is a very... it's a sect of Hinduism that is... It's a fierce yoga. It's a type of yoga where they... They literally will wear masks. First of all, they won't even eat anything with a. They won't eat an onion or a carrot because it's the root of the.
Oh, that's interesting.
It'll kill the plant, so they'll just eat the tops.
Really?
Yeah. So they won't do that. On top of that, they'll be very careful where they sit or walk. You see them sweeping the ground in front of them to move it out because they don't want to kill any organized.
Right. Well, if you...
The problem is life eats life. That's the problem. The problem in the wild is life eats life.
Well, but they have to. A tiger can't choose live.
The Maasai,
saying,
the Maasai,
you can make a
the Maasai,
they can't
the Israelis,
no.
People like that
if
who live
Maasai
in the
live,
desert
have
to do
it.
The same things.
Nobody's arguing that. Yeah. Everybody's just arguing saying if you live...
I just said the Maasai and the Israelis. But then I was just thinking about how sun-baked that part of the world is.
Course.
You're going to be a nomad. Back in the day, you were a nomad.
Back in the
you were
day.
A nomadic.
If you're in the middle of the desert, you've got to make do. You've got to figure out how to
I'll
survive.
I like to go way back to the Old Testament. The Israelites were they couldn't really plant shit. They had to live on their goats.
It's like, it really, you know, it's
No,
the idea
choice,
of that kind of morality,
choice,
given a choice,
you should try to
look at the way animals are treated.
The least
man.
Amount of suffering as you can.
If anybody watched a documentary about a factory farm and still was able to just go, it's like it's horrendous.
Yeah, it is. That's why I don't eat factory farmed meat.
Oh yeah. I don't.
Although
I just
had chicken.
Right, but it wasn't necessary. Well, we don't know where. I guess it wasn't necessarily.
I choose
free
to
range.
Believe it was. Free it range. Was actually flying in the air, and it died of old age in the middle of the air.
Flight.
Had a heart attack.
Yeah.
But it was had a smile on its beak.
Yeah, sure.
So, do chickens fly? I'll answer the question, no. They're grouses, wood grouses.
They're
very
grouse.
Elusive creatures, in
wood
fact.
Grouse.
If you're in the Amazon and you catch a grouse, which is really a wild chicken, a feral chicken, you're not going to get a lot of meat, and they're very hard to catch. But it would suck to be in the Amazon as a chicken,
right.
Regardless, because, my God, you're walking
yeah,
food.
Your food, yeah,
you're
right.
Scurrying food.
Yeah.
Just the way I feel about penguins. What the fuck do they do? They have to waddle miles and then they jump in the water and they're sea lions. There's those sea leopards.
Yeah, it's brutal. Although the penguins are surprisingly agile in the water. They're
you know,
good
a leopard seal will kill a man, right? They'll eat a man.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, they'll
kill you. Know that.
Oh, no, a leopard seal will fucking kill
you. It's fine. It's interesting when things that are sort of seem cute pet like.
Just Google they'll take a leopard seal. Yeah. I'm going to fucking do it right now.
What time is it, by the way?
We are good. We are, it's 9:24. What time do you got to get out of here?
I got to go, man.
You got to go?
Yeah, I got to be there.
I think this was good. We got a lot done here.
We got it done.
I appreciate you coming out.
Hey, anytime, bro.
This was Dove Davidoff, ladies and gentlemen, and we will have him back. We will have him back. We're at 35 minutes, which is exactly how I like to keep things short, sweet,
cogent,
and alive.
Yeah,
thanks for listening to the Brian Callen Show. I wish I could say I was going to be doing stand-up in June. I'm going to be doing the Parlor Live, I think the 12th through the 14th of July. But I go to New York to shoot a movie with Michael Rapaport and John Stamos for the month of June, and I'm pumped about that. It's called My Man is a Loser, written by my buddy, written and directed by my dear friend Mike Young. I'm very proud of him. All right, man. Thanks for listening to the Brian Callen Show. Dove Davidoff, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. God bless.
Pearls of wisdom.
Pearls of wisdom. See you in Miami Improv. Okay.